Hey, cashiers. We Have the Receipts podcast is coming at you live from Netflix is a Joke Fest in Los Angeles.
Chris, are you kidding?
No, Netflix is a joke, Courtney, but this is not one of them. Our listeners in LA have the chance to join us for a live recording of our podcast, We Have the Receipts, hosted by me, Chris Burns.
And me, Courtney Revolution.
Join us and a few surprise guests from your favorite Netflix reality shows on Saturday, May 4th at 1 p.m. at a secret location in Hollywood.
To be announced.
Get your tickets for the We Have the Receipts live show at tudum.com/WHTR. That's Tudum, TUDUM.com/WHTR.
Tickets are limited. If you can't make it to the show, we still want to hear your beautiful voice. Leave us a message at speakpipe.com/WeHaveTheReceipts.
You may even hear your own voice on the show.
Grab a ticket at tudum.com/WHTR.
And we'll see you on May 4th in Los Angeles. Bye, cashiers.
You're listening to Skip Intro with me, Krista Smith. Go big or go home. That statement feels synonymous with the style of director Zack Snyder, who has brought giant spectacles to our screens since the beginning of his career. He doesn't pull any punches with his latest undertaking, Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver, which continues to expand the sci-fi universe that was introduced to audiences with Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire. I caught up with Zack a few weeks ago, after he had had a long day of press. I had initially hoped to meet in person in New York City, both of us having spent the early years of our respective careers there. Me, covering the entertainment industry for Vanity Fair, and Zack shooting commercials for major brands like Nike and Budweiser. But life had other plans.
Krista.
Hi, Zack.
Why am I not with you in person?
I don't know. I'm here in LA and you're in New York and I'm bummed I'm not there. I'm always impressed and equally amazed by the level of energy that Zack infuses into all his interactions. Not only was he on a 6-hour back-to-back interview schedule at this point, but he'd spent the previous evening celebrating the upcoming release of The Scargiver, and its official inspired by EP companion album, Rebel Moon, Songs of the Rebellion. The event also featured an exclusive photo gallery by Zack, showcasing dynamic behind-the-scenes images of the cast and creatures from the film. These portraits will be featured in an upcoming coffee table book that Zack is publishing. Having a love for photography myself, I was excited to ask Zack about his relationship to the art form.
The book was really fun. I built this crazy photographic kind of box, kind of Irving Penn style, and we would move that around with us wherever we were on the production. And I would go, okay, get in there and let's take some portraits before we shoot. My mom was a photography teacher and a photographer. And my brother was a photographer. I grew up with cameras as well as a movie camera. I had a Super 8 movie camera, of course, in my hand a lot of the time. Then when I started shooting TV commercials, I always had these Polaroid Land cameras that I traveled with. I would use the Polaroids to judge exposure. And basically what you would do is take a picture of the set with your lighting up, and then you'd peel open the Polaroid about a minute after you exposed it, and you'd have this beautiful, pristine, mostly I shot black and white, sort of that gave you a sense of the balance of the scene. And that is to say, like, if the backlight was too strong, you'd be able to see it in the Polaroid even better than the naked eye. So I was constantly just shooting Polaroids of like people and things and objects and a lot of portraiture. But then what happened was I was introduced to these Leica digital cameras about 10 years ago. For Army of the Dead, I built these incredible lenses. All of the portraits in the portrait book were shot with those lenses that I had built for Army.
In case you haven't picked up on it yet, how Zack does one thing is how he does all things. His tendency to become captivated with a subject started when he was growing up in Connecticut. Zack seemingly had an all-American childhood. He was an exceptional athlete who loved playing football, was obsessed with Star Wars. I mean, what kid in 1977 wasn't? And attended church with his family. But there were other things that separated him from his peers. He was obsessed with late 20th century pop culture and would devour anything he could get his hands on. Comic books like Heavy Metal, Watchmen, and the Ninja Turtles. Films like Raiders of the Lost Ark, All That Jazz, and pretty much anything Stanley Kubrick made. It was the mythology that these works of fiction offered that mesmerized Zach, and he would return to them again and again and again and try and unpack how they worked. At the top of that list was John Borman's 1981 film, Excalibur.
The one that's kind of resonated for me over the years is John Borman's Excalibur is really kind of stuck with me in that it is adult mythology, weirdly, which is a really rare animal. When the bell is struck correctly, it really resonates through you, this sort of archetypal, mythological, sort of Joseph Campbellian, deep, primordial storytelling. I mean, I think that movie probably, as far as longevity for me, is probably the one that I haven't grown out of, I guess.
When Zach enrolled at Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, he found himself among a group of students who could relate to his ceaseless appetite for cinema and world building, and who shared his crazy dreams of seeing his work on the big screen.
I was with Michael Bay, Tarsim, Larry Fong. These were all my friends in film school. And the film department was really small.
Yeah.
And actually, Matthew Ralston had gotten his degree in photography and then came back to learn some film stuff because he was going to shoot some commercials. And I remember him like using a GQ spread because we had an assignment in one of our cinematography classes to use neon to light a scene. And he used a GQ editorial spread to do his Art Center assignment, which I thought was awesome.
That's a baller move. It was during this time that the idea behind Rebel Moon started to form. Zach's professor asked the class to come up with a pitch for an existing story set in a new environment. Zach pitched The Dirty Dozen in space.
We were all sort of idealistic young film students with like big ideas about making big sci-fi movies and whether or not that was going to happen or not. None of us knew, but we definitely had the scale to dream. We obviously didn't believe it was impossible, so that's the good news.
After graduation, Zach got his start shooting and directing commercials. He had great success early on, and it was during this time that he met his wife, Deborah.
She hired me to make a TV commercial. She was working here in New York City as an agency producer at BBDO, and they hired me to make this soft and dry deodorant commercial, and we went to New Zealand, and it was awesome.
They went on to marry in 2004. That same year, the pair formed their production company, Stone Quarry. Unlike her creative tornado of a husband, Deborah is a self-proclaimed type A personality who's an expert at advocating for Zach throughout the filmmaking process, but also reining him in when necessary. As he puts it,
it's a unique relationship. It's this rare thing because we're never not working, but we're not sad about that. We love doing it. We love the business. We love making stuff. She stokes the fire in me constantly, challenges me like crazy, but also supports me like crazy. I'm incredibly lucky in that way because I wouldn't be close to what I've been able to achieve without her because she's pretty hard taskmaster, but she's also this voice of reason that levels me and keeps me on task in a great way. And also is an incredible problem solver. So having a partner like that who can jump on the phone with anybody, head of the studio or, you know, whoever, and duke it out in the most, you know, in a way I couldn't. It's just something to behold.
Zach's first feature was a remake of the 1978 zombie horror film, Dawn of the Dead. It was a big commercial success, grossing over $100 million worldwide on a $26 million budget. This would launch Zach onto other projects like 300, Sucker Punch, and Man of Steel. Dawn of the Dead also included a director's cut. This provided audiences with additional footage. As he explained, those early extended cuts were born out of a need to show audiences the original intention behind his projects.
The director's cuts of, say, Dawn of the Dead, which was the first movie ever made, I think the director's cut is better than the theatrical version. They were all created in response to a note, you know, that I got. Like I'd get a note from the studio to take this out. And I was like, man, I just can't, it doesn't make sense to me, right? Like, like it's better leaving it in. They're like, you don't get it, kid. You got to cut it out. It was some of that. So, you know, I would go across the street to DVD and say, hey guys, do you want this long version? At the end, they'd be like, absolutely. Extended version? Like that's our bread and butter over here. Like we need the extended version. Once I established that relationship and sort of understood the economics of it, I always felt safe with the DVD people. And Watchmen and BVS are really great examples of, I think, how DVD sort of saves a version of the movie. That goes to an extreme for Justice League, of course.
By the time Zack Snyder's Justice League was released in 2021, it was known simply as the Snyder Cut. Zack's work had become synonymous with distinct world-building, mythology, and gore that he was able to explore in the longer versions of his films. It was around this time that Zack decided he was ready to turn his long-awaited dream of Rebel Moon into a reality. He was wrapping up work on Netflix's Army of the Dead, and he was excited to continue the collaboration. After sitting down with Netflix, it was decided that there would be a PG-13 version and an extended version of both Rebel Moon Part 1 and Rebel Moon Part 2.
When we made the deal, we had built into it this idea that we were going to do an extended version alongside the PG-13 versions. Because I wrote a very hard R-rated movie because I feel like what I wrote was in response to Star Wars and sci-fi movies in companionship. It was a way to sort of get at, theoretically, the limitations of what sci-fi can offer than it was to sort of glorify it. I'm a huge advocate of the PG-13 versions, but I feel like they don't reflect what I would call the deconstructivist nature of the R-rated sort of original vision of the movie.
Zack's usual workflow was flipped on its head. Not only was Netflix on board with the idea of creating extended versions of each film prior to pre-production, but Zack would also be able to shoot scenes exclusively for those extended cuts, opening up a whole new level of possibilities.
I do like that we did the director's cuts as a premeditated, not as a response. There's a version of the movie that exists outside of any studio notes, and that is the director's cut of the film. It was in the first time where I felt like responding to the studio's desire to have the movie be shorter, desire to have it be sort of a more inclusive as far as the audience is concerned, the age range, all of that I was happy to do because I knew over here was this crazy version of the movie that would be very boutique-y and very weird. But that satisfied my sort of original idea for what the movie could be. I think the PG-13s, the limited way I can use sex and violence in them, they become very earnest. Weirdly, you would think that a more sexual and more violent version would be more serious. But in a lot of ways, I think the more sexual and the more violent version is more over the top and so allows the satirical nature of the movie to be a little bit more in the front, as opposed to in the PG-13, it feels a little bit more earnest, a little bit more like, oh, this is the movie. It's very straightforward. It's an incredible sort of cinematic experience to make those two movies at the same time and to have a relationship with Netflix where they're comfortable with me making what would we'd call a movie for a broad audience over here. And over here, the sort of freakiest boutique version of that movie and allow them to exist at the same time and to be compared to each other and talked about in that way. Whatever the opinion is, will be the opinion and that's fine. But that conversation is yet to be had.
It's no secret that Zack's work is polarizing, particularly because he has a habit of taking pop culture icons that many fans hold as sacred, like Superman and Batman, and deconstructing them through his films. Even though the Rebel Moon franchise is its own IP, I asked Zack about how he navigates the inevitable online chatter. I just love how you embrace the divisiveness around some of your films. I love that. It's like it's almost become its own sport.
It really is its own sport. Even with this movie, I think it's really interesting that part one of Rebel Moon is whatever it is and the way it hit the zeitgeist and however people feel about it. But how part two affects the way people sort of receive part one is really going to be a story. And then when the director's cuts come out, the director's cuts themselves are going to be a massive story on how their relationship to how people perceive part one and part two, and what are they? And like, what did I mean by that? I love that that is all a big stew that everyone's going to have to like wade into and bathe in, because it's fun. It's fun to have those arrows in the quiver of the way sort of popular culture is going to have to digest those things beyond the movies. The movies are the movies. I'm proud of them. And I love that they exist, but it's another thing entirely, another game anyway, to see how, you know, the critics and pop culture and Twitter and all the things, they all fight about what does it mean?
Once he established the workflow for the Rebel Moon films, Zach jumped right into pre-production. Both films were going to be shot back to back, so there needed to be extensive planning on the front end.
I began the process of drawing and sort of conceptualizing everything. All that kind of happened at the same time. We have a mythological world to design. We have a hardware world to design, i.e. ships, things like that. And by mythological, I mean creation stories for Moa, Princess Issa mythologies and resurrection stories and all that stuff. And then we also have to start the work on the backstories for all the different characters beyond the story itself, i.e. comic books and things like that, like real mythological groundwork that has to be created. And then I basically take the script and I start just drawing the scenes as I wrote them, you know, and sort of visualize them. And that tool is super helpful for everyone because it allows us to know what kind of sets to build. And I try and stick to that as best I can. There's a big money savings when I'm strict with the drawings because everyone knows what we're filming. And I always go like, look at this drawings now. Don't look at the script anymore. People are very trained in Hollywood. To like, you know, it says here, he does that. And I'm like, yeah, look at the drawings. It's more accurate because those are the actual shots. Then we have these big production meetings where we go over all the drawings and all the designs and everything. In the meantime, we're doing costumes and casting. And then we start with the process of camera tests where we start filming costumes and actors. And hopefully that leads us to a place where we have all of our sets built, all of our cast done, script has been noted and is ready to go. And then we begin the process of filming. The nice thing about Rebel Moon was that's the first movie that we shot in LA. I never gotten a chance. You'd think, oh, they shoot now. We never shot a movie in at home before. And so it was cool to sleep in our own beds and shoot it in Hollywood. Apparently there's sound stages in Hollywood. I never knew. We went and we shot at Sunset and Gower. And then we built our sets up in the up north of LA.
As the shoot kicked off, there were still a few challenges ahead, namely growing two gigantic wheat fields.
One of the tricks with Rebel Moon was there is a giant sequence of harvesting in the film, a kind of Days of Heaven in space, if you will. That was interesting because it relied on us having the wheat being ready to be harvested at a certain point in the schedule, which, as you can imagine, did not happen. The wheat was not where it was supposed to be when it was supposed to be there. That was one of the big challenges of shooting, was having the wheat not be ready to be harvested when we were ready to harvest it according to the schedule.
I assume that's where your partner in crime and life partner, Debbie Snyder, comes in and is like, okay, how are we rearranging how we're shooting today?
Yes, 100%. And actually, she was very cool because she saw it coming, I think, before everyone else did. I had taken some wheat from our set in a big box and I had it at the house. And I would water it and get it ready. And that way I could sort of monitor its growth while we were shooting on stage and stuff. I'd come home at night. I had like a ruler, like a yardstick stuck in the box. She was like, that's not going to be ready in 2 weeks to like harvest. And I was like, you don't think? And she's like, absolutely not. And so that process, having her sort of headed off was, it allowed us to like push things forward in the schedule and get things film things early and stuff like that, so that eventually we could get to it correctly. But it was a huge headache and it was a huge challenge. But it was, again, when we got to that giant wheat field, it was insane.
In addition to tracking the growth of his wheat over the course of the production, Zach had his hands full, not only as the director, but also as the film cinematographer. For many of his actors, it was necessary to pull off incredible complex fight choreography during the battle scenes. As a lifelong fitness enthusiast, Zach has prioritized his actors' training all the way back to films like 300. Believe it or not, there were no visual effects used on Gerard Butler in that film. There is always a gym on a Zack Snyder set where the cast and crew are invited to work out. I love the way you shoot action. Did you have a favorite sequence that you shot in Scargiver that we can talk about?
All the battle scenes in Veldt themselves, which were kind of like, you know, just like a war movie, kind of part of the movie. I mean, you don't know exactly, but you kind of understand, oh, there's going to be some pyrotechnics. We're going to blow that thing up. The tank is going to blow up that building while the guys hide behind these walls, and they're going to run and they're going to try and put some sticky bombs on the, you know, whatever it is. That was really fun to do. But the truth is, I think for me, sort of Cora running around the spaceship, setting her bombs and kind of fighting the guys in the hallways, that was kind of more fun for me because I just, you know, it's like a spaceship. So, I mean, I'm a dork. If I get to like run around in some sci-fi spaceship hallways, I'm pretty happy. Sophia is such a gifted athlete and actor that it really is it's like a pleasure to watch her and sort of collaborate with her when it comes to trying to design some sort of crazy fighting or action for her to do, because she can do anything. It's a problem of imagination for us more than normally. I can like bump up against where the actors just can't do it anymore. But with her, it's quite a ways to get to that point.
Couldn't have found a better leading lady for Cora, because it felt very real. It felt they were doing it. I have no problem believing that they did all their stunts, just short of risking their lives.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that, yeah, they really, and they would have gone like a lot, anytime when it was like dodgy enough where we would have to bring the double in, they'd fight me like crazy. So I was like, guys, just for the love of the movie, for insurance, for God's sake.
As we wrapped up our conversation, I asked the question that we were all wondering at this point, or at least I was. Does Zach have time for literally anything else other than filmmaking? Surprisingly, he does.
I still play badminton. When I'm shooting, I don't get as much time to play, but I play normally Sundays with my coach.
It's just funny to me that it's badminton and no pickleball, because everyone's trying to talk me into pickleball.
We play a little bit of pickleball. We have a pickleball court in the backyard, so we've been playing a bit of pickleball as a sort of a family game. I'm trying to encourage that as a activity. It's a slow process, but they're starting to come around.
All right. What about Fortnite? You still gaming on Fortnite?
I've slowed down my Fortnite a little bit. Debbie got mad. She called me like 3 o'clock in the morning and was like, honestly, this is too much. You gotta, because I had switched over to making pottery. So I do like, I hand build, which is like, basically I do like pinch pots, pinch mugs. And I have two kilns downstairs. Since my birthday, I've been back pretty much focused on my pottery.
On the pottery.
Trying to get, you know, some plates and mugs knocked out.
As for what Zach has coming up next?
I'm finishing the director's cuts of Rebel Moon right now. I'm in the process of finishing the cuts. And then after that, I'm going to start writing. There's something I want to write. I kind of want to do a small movie just because I'm a little bit like exhausted by these giant movies. Not in a bad way. I just was like, yeah, I'd love to do something kind of on location, you know, in LA, something, I don't know. But yeah, I got some ideas, so we'll see.
Rebel Moon Part 1, A Child of Fire, and Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver, are streaming now on Netflix. And stay tuned for the extended versions of both of these films, which will be released later this year. Thanks so much for joining me. I'm Krista Smith, your host and creator of the show. Skip Intro is produced and edited by Isabel Arricchio and engineered by Dave Corwin. Special thanks to our coordinator, Alyssa Hillman. Please subscribe, rate, and review Skip Intro wherever you've been listening. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Krista Smith. If you enjoy the podcast, please go to NetflixQue.com for more. That's NetflixQueue.com.